John Hogue, special guest this hour. We'll take calls sometime this hour with John. I've got so much more to talk with him about prophecy. And, of course, I want to wrap up this third secret of Fatima. And I might as well let the cat out of the bag. John is going to be one of our very special guests. We're going back to Everett, Washington next year, which is only a few months away now. March 23rd will be the live event at the historic Everett Theater. Friday, I will tell you how you can start getting your tickets, and we'll have it posted on the coasttocoastam.com website. But John Hogue will be one of our special guests there, and he's just a wonderful boy. If you like him on the radio, wait till you see him in person. But we'll be back with John Hogue in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. John Hogue with us. So the third prophecy and some of the controversy about that third prophecy, it had to do with the Pope assassination attempt. It has to do with, is it the apocalypse? Is it end times? And John, you think it was doctored?
I think it was faked. And I thought it was an important thing, and I said it in the actual footage that didn't get into this.
They left you on the cutting room floor, huh?
Yeah, well, and it would have been fine if it all was there, or if they let me say it and say, okay, that's Hogue's view, let's refute it, and actually extend it over to meaning it's about the Francis, the Pope, that's currently there. What my concern is that... that it makes it look like I'm endorsing something that, which I actually said the opposite, that I did not endorse. And it's got me a little concerned that I'm glad I can speak on this show and tell everybody that that's not my view and that I do not support anything that points to the current Pope being martyred from what was released by Cardinal Ratzinger, a Pope who went down in scandal several years later and had to resign, that it is not, I do not put this on the current Pope. I'm even thinking of writing him a letter about it. So you know, that's where I stand on it.
Will he be the last Pope?
Well, according to the prophecies of St. Malachi, which around 1140 started this whole Latin motto progression, there's certain codes that follow it, and if it all lines up right, it's supposed to be him as the last pope. Now, that can mean a lot of things in prophecy. He's already broken many traditions. He's also actually with the Pope Benedict, who was often thought to be the pope at the beginning of the apostasy, the crisis in the highest echelons of the church. I think that's a little unfair to Pope Benedict, because actually what he created with all the rat lines for all the pedophilic priests was something that his boss, who's now a saint, John Paul II, ordered him to do. So his mistake was that he kept it going.
That he kept it going and refused the order, basically.
Yeah, and that there's a policy that's probably endemic of kind of isolated but very powerful circles of power. It's not just Washington that has this problem. It's also the Vatican. It was much more ancient in its political intrigues. Often what happens to the parents that complain and say, we don't want to take this to the police, they say, no, you'll hurt the church. And it seems like the church is, I sometimes wonder, and I'm only conjecturing here, but since Sister Lucia was always in silence about all this, I sometimes wonder if she was also said, don't say anything about that, you'll hurt the church. That becomes, that's first over little kids, that's first over telling truth. And that has led to what makes St. Malachi's prophecies leading to at least an understanding that we're in the last popes as we've known them, and that a lot of other Catholic seers, which I've written about in several books, have also seen this period as a crisis, uniquely to the apocalyptic interpretations of the Bible, the Catholic Church, which focuses more initially on a crisis at the very highest state of power of the Church. And that the whole process, which may have the book of Revelations involved in it or not, although there's a lot of things I could contend that would excuse that being a contemporary prophecy for fulfillment 2,000 years ago rather than now. And I'm writing further about this. In fact, a lot of what I'm talking about today I can only touch upon. But if anybody's really interested in hearing the full scale of what I'm trying to say and how and what you missed of what I did say in this interview that got cut out, just go to hogueprophecy.com, and in these 13 articles that are just currently posted today, you'll find them in the middle of them, my review on the History Channel documentary in two parts. And that'll get into this. It'll also get into some pretty unusual new ways of looking at what the apostasy might really be. And I'll only hint on one thing. I may actually write a whole book about this theme that came up in the process of writing this, is that if you look at there's one prophecy in the New Testament, which is the closest thing we have as witness to the Apostle Matthew and John and Mark being on the Mount of Olives, asking Jesus what he meant by the temple being destroyed and it'd be raised again in 3 days. And in that process, it's the only time we really have Jesus in the flesh, or Yeshua, as he was actually called, explaining one-on-one to his disciples. The book of Revelation is actually an angel going between John of Patmos in his cave in incarceration of the Roman legions and Jesus. So it's a three-way conversation with a go-between. This is Jesus talking to his disciples. And intriguingly enough, I think a lot of what he's saying is really about a crisis in faith in those in that passage. But what it started dawning on me is that I'm always impacted by the fact that the most influential religion in the last 2,000 years that has dominated the world now, even if people are not involved in it, its context is the dominant context. But it's the only major religion where no one prays or speaks the actual name, the birth-given name, that if Jesus was the Son of God, why aren't we calling him by the name God blessed him with? Yeshua. He gets this name after a few centuries from the same empire that did such a great job Romanizing all the other religions that it controlled, that it conquered. It wouldn't throw down the gods of other people. It just incorporated as part of the pantheon of gods. And when you look at who actually created the Christian religion as a big religion, it was Constantine the Great, the Emperor of Rome. He was actually not a Christian. He was a worshiper of a monotheistic religion called Sol Invictus, and he saw the perfect possibility bureaucratically of melding these two groups, a legal and an illegal monotheistic religion, so that he could get enough allies to win a civil war, which he did, and with the help of the Christians. So it was a political deal that created the establishment, which led to the Council of Nicaea, which really decided which books were in the New Testament, which books were censored from the New Testament. And it was his faction in that group, the Catholic bishops' faction, that won out.
Is all this catching up with the Catholic Church?
I think it's catching up with... It's a pressure for all Christians to consider. Even if you call yourself a Christian, that was a derogatory term that pagan Romans gave to Christians.
Sure.
Little Christies. Oh, here comes the little Christ.
So they could butcher them.
And so what I'm saying is that I feel that I could go on for hours about this, but to try to edit myself down as much as I can.
I'm going to leave you on the editing floor, John.
Yeah. The thing is that we are seeing a moment coming in this century, in this first half of this century, where religions will see the other side of their prophecies, the part the door has been shut to.
Yep.
And there's indications in prophecy, in Christian prophecy even, that shows that what's on the other side of this revelation will completely change the concept and leave behind even the identity of what it was to be Christian, what it was to be Muslim, what it was to be Buddhist. All of that will be left on this side of the door. And what's on the other side is completely different. That's all I can hint right now.
I can't let a night go by without asking you about the Middle East, and then we'll start taking phone calls or lining up here for you. But what's your take, prophetically, on what's going to happen in the Middle East with Syria and Iran and this whole situation?
Well, it's unfortunately, with all the things we've been talking about, specifically since 2014 when I alerted you on Coast to Coast and everybody about how we were now in Cold War 2.0.
Yes.
And how it follows a prophetic place where the flashpoint is the Middle East. I mean, one of the 10 predictions I made in 10 predictions for this year was how we'd come much closer to a war with Iran. That's happened. Syria is an ally of Iran, and it is always, long story short, the Nostradamus prophecies that are quite clear about this is that the two eagle kings of the north get pulled in. This is Russian double eagle and the American bald eagle countries get pulled in because of their allies, their vassals, which are described in an anagram as Arab vassals, barbare, d'Arab in French. That kind of rebel against their masters and drag Russia and America into a war. And that can happen with the issue of Iran. Even the last few 24 hours, we've rescinded a peace treaty that we've had with Iran since 1955. Of course, it was with their dictator, the Shah, after we overthrew their government 2 years earlier that was democratically elected. That doesn't get told you in the U.S. press.
Goodbye, Mossadegh, right?
Mossadegh, yeah. CIA took him down to help British Petroleum retain Iranian oil. And then they helped train the SAVAK, which is as bad as the Gestapo in Germany, and terrorized the people. It's one of the reasons why the Islamic...
That's why they threw the Shah out eventually.
Yes, and so there's bad karma here, and we're basically blindsided to our side in this, and we need to take a look at how we've kind of gotten here karmically. Now, so we have a situation with Idlib, which really got me concerned in August, where it's the last province where 50,000 Al-Qaeda affiliates, who we've been supporting...
That's a city in Syria for people.
In Syria, yeah. We're going to make their last stand against the Syrian Arab Army and the Russian Air Force, and the Turks were also involved. What happened in the 11th hour, just before it started, is Erdogan of Turkey, the president of Turkey, and Vladimir Putin got together and made a pact to not do the offensive, to create a buffer zone, a demilitarized zone, and take the time to do something to help the people, the 3 million people, half of which are refugees, all crowd that area.
Oh, it's
so
horrible. Yeah.
What's good about that is it's an attempt not to have this thing happen. I know from my sources that there were a lot of, they already had staged and filmed the White Helmets, who are basically Al-Qaeda's ER, had already taken children and used them in some gassing attack. That's the story I'm trying to track down. And it was going to be broadcast as hostility started as, once again, another false flag that the Syrian regime had chemically weaponized them. And that would have caused, we have 30 Russian warships as this time around, and a near equal number of American ships crowding the Eastern Mediterranean. Long story short, we have a lot of military potential in a tight area that if a miscalculation happened, it could get serious. And then one thing can lead to another into a nuclear confrontation. I mean, the missiles of October in 62 can become the missiles of October 2018 or 2019. The astrology kind of points to, and some of the deadlines Nostradamus gave to a long and a short deadline, if we kind of move up what may be the official start of the Cold War, when the Russians announced they had achieved a parity in March 1st this year, they delayed Putin delayed his address to the nation of Russia, and then he could see what the military changes of rules of engagement was going to happen with the Americans. I actually quoted a lot of this speech, and it shows it's a very interesting look at how we've been in an arms race again with Russia because we pulled out of the ABM missile treaty, and which was a seriously destabilizing move to unilaterally do. Long story short, they had to create a new system of weapons that could be a deterrent to us surrounding Russia steadily with anti-ballistic missile batteries to basically be able to shoot down their missiles so they couldn't defend themselves. Very, very destabilizing move, hardly reported. So the Russians declared on March 1st that pretty much we're in this Cold War, and they have now made a parity. Now, interestingly enough, Putin drops $10 billion off the $80 billion budget of the Russian defense. At the same time, Trump adds another $37 billion to something that's past $700 billion. If you add the other sides to it, we're really spending $1.1 trillion on defense spending in our military. Ironically, it's half of what the U.S. people produce monetarily, GDP, every year, which is exactly what happened at the same time when the Soviet Union collapsed. It was paying half of its money into its big military, and it collapsed. We're doing the same thing. So it reminds me of prophecies of Ambres, which was a spirit that was channeled by Sture Johansson, who was considered the Swedish Edgar Casey in the 1980s, and because he channeled similarly in trance. And he would say things like, you'll see the one side, you know, the Cold War would end, Russia would become more free, and America would become more like the Soviet Union. And in, at least in this economic sense, that's true. With more censorship that's happening to alternative voices, you know, that's also, I would say, from my own experience with journalism, that we're definitely looking more and more like the Soviet Union I grew up with than the country I grew up with.
No, that's true. In the last minutes we have before the break, then we'll take final calls next half hour. You're writing a book about celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain, who committed suicide. This intrigues me. Why are you doing this?
Well, I've been watching Anthony Bourdain since 2005. I've learned so much about his unique, kind of rebellious but brilliant, unorthodox way of kind of dragging me along to see the world, many of the same places I ate in my travel.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of taking us through a journey through the stomach to really meet with people. When people break bread, it's a connection. It's what I was saying earlier in the show, how we need to talk to each other rather than polarize. Well, have a big banquet. Have all the red Republicans and the blue Democrats break bread together, like Anthony would do. So anyway, I watched the show. I also saw that this brilliant man is doing what a lot of potentially brilliant people, and he's also a seeker, a spiritual seeker, in a true sense, because he wasn't buying into easy rationales of belief. He was really questioning things. And, of course, seeing the world like he was seeing the darker sides of it as well. And it wasn't a surprise to me that he committed suicide, because I feel, as much as I love him, I also had similar issues in my own life.
Oh, really? Let's talk about that, John, when we come back in a moment, and then we'll take your calls. Those of you on hold, just hang right there. Well, next hour, we're going to talk about the devil. Don't panic. We're going to win. In the long run, we're going to win on something like that. We're going to be back with phone calls and John Hoag in just a moment. His website, hoagprophecy.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, John Hoag with us. We'll get to your calls in just a second. I just have one more area to talk with John about, and he's writing a book about the late celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain. And boy, you sparked my interest, John, because it sounds like you had a very similar situation. What happened?
I did. It's really a tale of two suicides. And both of us committed the suicide. The reason I am speaking to you is because my experience with suicide was a spiritual suicide rather than the usual what I call mundane suicides that most people encounter. Basically, in the mundane suicide, I contend that you end up with your pain destroying the body-mind that your mystery of soul is living in. But in the suicide that happened to me, rather than the one that I was indeed mundanely going to do, I saw my misery and my pain commit suicide, and I remained. And so this is one of my most intimate autobiographical tales of about whole other dimensions of my life.
Of all these years, I've never known this.
Oh, yeah. I was walking through a golf course in San Pedro, California. I'd just come back from India, and I was still in the tender opening, kind of broke out of my shell of many lives, being with my teacher in India for the first time. And when I came back in the world that was not a place that supported this kind of individual flowering, and I was having a very bad day. And so I was walking down this beautiful, beautiful golf course adjacent to the trailer park that I lived in, overlooking Santa Catalina Island and San Pedro Cliffs. And as I was walking, it just dawned on me, it says, I could just keep walking beyond these cliffs and plummet down 300 feet into the rocks. And I was going to do it because suddenly I had this amazing, unexpected experience of life and death suddenly being very tangible and clear. I got to see how they're really one. They're a play of complementaries, or in our fear, they're a play of terror and opposites. But what was happening to me, the feeling was, I tried to describe it, but it's beyond words, really, beyond belief, indeed. It was like it was descending on me, vaster than myself. And I thought, okay, this is happening because I have made the decision to throw myself, walk over this cliff. If I turn away from this, I'm going to lose this amazing experience that's overtaking me, this mystery of life meeting death. So I saw this little eucalyptus tree, and I sat up against it, and I said, okay, before I throw myself over, I just want to feel this and take this with me over the edge. And so I sat there, just going inside and feeling it. And at some point, I felt this electrical energy just rise up out of the ground through the roots of the tree and throw me forward face down into the crabgrass, where I just began sobbing and sobbing. And suddenly all of that. Otherwise, I wouldn't be telling this
you
story.
No, not at all.
And there was this moment after I cried it all out, I turned and there was the little eucalyptus tree, and it was just shivering its leaves in the Santa Ana wind. And it was just this moment where I realized the sky, the earth, the tree, existence loved me. Existence sees everything that's created out of it as a phenomenal creation rising and falling, as something absolutely integral, significant. And I had this feeling that so much of what society does to make us feel insignificant, when you go in, even at that moment of life meeting death, insignificant becomes insignificant. So this story is really it's a jump from what I usually write about. It's a whole other level of talking about these things that I haven't done since I did the Messiah's book back in 1999. Sometimes these books, you see, I don't write these books. They use me to write themselves. And I had no idea until Anthony Bourdain died how deeply his suicide, how much he was loved and how many people were shocked. In the story, I talk about the moment that inspired me to write this book. I'm in a cashier's line, and there's this old lady, and she's doing something that looks like she's never done before. She's pulled, actually, a magazine out of the rack and looks at it, and it's the People magazine of Anthony Bourdain. And I watched how she touched his cheek on the picture, and the way she did it was so intimate and beautiful. And that's when I realized, yeah, I loved him just as much, and I think I understand what he was going through. He was not a man to believe in fairy tales and imaginary stuff, and that Santa Claus is going to save him from his sins and all
right.
that. It's really
he's pretty practical.
And people like that, when they die, I always feel, well, there's a person that has the potential to become an awakened one. And as I have been in my private life, which I'm sharing more and more now in this period, especially now when there's so much turmoil, when there's so much angst and polarity, my inner life now as a meditator is now coming more and more into my work, because it is this still point, this center of silence and peace in the cyclone of life that's becoming stronger and stronger. That is what I can share with all of you, is meditation, the science of self-observation, is what more and more I always thought my work would evolve more and more in. It's still prophetic, but it's going to have more of my own authority through my own experiences.
Good for you, John. Let's take some calls here in the 10 minutes we've got left. Thomas in La Jolla, you're on with John Hogue, Tom.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. And John, wow, it's hard to follow your sharing of your experience on that. But my question, John, is for a person to walk in the world, to be a participant in the world, how can they develop their own centeredness, so to speak, such that they are unafflicted, unaffected, untouched by personal and planetary astrology?
Well, what I can only suggest, and I think only anyone who's honest and heart-to-heart with anybody is, all I can suggest is my own experiences, the meditation techniques that I've been using since 1980. And so my answer to that is, if any of you listening to this resonate with what I've been saying, especially with the issue of suicide and life meeting death, I am on a path where I can say there is a way to look beyond and not be touched. You can be passionate and deeply into life, but you're not overwhelmed. You can be a Buddha in the marketplace, but not of the marketplace, of the world. And that was what my teacher taught, Osho, and that is what I've lived since 1980, since I went to India to see him for the first time. And so, with that said, if you go to hogueprophecy.com, and if you click on the contact menu button, just in that email, all you need to do is leave one word in the subject line, meditation. I'll know immediately what you want, and I will give you links and information that will show you stuff on YouTube and also some of the meditations that I do. And then just see if they resonate with you. If they don't, perfectly fine. This is not a religion. This is not a new system of control. This is actually a system of being free of all that. And from that freedom, from that silent point, one's innate God-given, existence-given intelligence can effortlessly rise. All the times we try to be moral is an effort that meditations teaches me, that we have a spontaneous morality and intelligence within us already. And when you're silent and flowing and celebrating whatever life gives you, these things begin to spontaneously come forth effortlessly. The truth is effortless. It's not a big work. And these meditations might help.
Pierre in Kansas City, Missouri is with us. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I've got a question for John. A number of years ago, I think it was on Coast to Coast, I heard that the Earth's axis shifted 13 degrees. Haven't heard much about that since. Have you any predictions about that physical phenomena?
No, I don't see any axis shifts happening. And a lot of the stuff that's been ballyhooed a lot, in my view, about the poles shifting their magnetic field, I actually study that, and it happens quite frequently. I mean, in geological
terms. It comes and it goes and comes back.
Yeah, it's not going to cause all the apocalyptic stuff that I've heard so many people with their hair on fire and all the TV shows I've been talk about. At least that's my view.
Next up, Nancy's in Victoria, Texas. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I have two questions for the guest.
Sure.
Okay. My first question is, what does John Hughes' prophecy is when it comes to natural disasters in the next year or two? And my second question is the 2020 presidential election, and who would be a excellent opponent to give President Trump a run for his money?
Well, I'll ask the first one first. Unfortunately, what my eighth prophecy in the 10 predictions for 2018 was almost 100% certain about how we would have record-breaking summer heats and that the hurricane season would end in something to rival the kind of floods and rains that happened in Houston, Texas. And unfortunately, this is the next 3 years are going to see a critical spike in temperatures rising, fires, and major storms. It is hopeful that the good that can come out of this is that at last people can understand this is like a Mother Nature sending us a Pearl Harbor event to wake up the nation, to stir the sleeping giant of Americans, like what happened when Pearl Harbor stirred us and we helped the last major planetary crisis, which was fighting the Axis forces in World War II. This is the same cycle again, only it's a different history rhymes. It doesn't repeat itself. This now is a planetary disaster of our own making because of lifestyle changes the human race must make sooner or later. And unfortunately, if it is not made in these critical times, almost like nature is going to try to hit us so hard in the next 3 years that we really get serious about looking at changing, getting off fossil fuels and curtailing this greenhouse effect. Because if we don't, the scientists are now starting to see that by 2030, if we have not, in the next 3 years, started seriously to change things and fight this enemy, which is our own stupidity with the Earth, by 2030, we will reach a point where we will get a 2 degrees Celsius increase. And once that happens, we are in a potential accelerating global warming event that could threaten human civilization. The Earth will be fine. The Earth will outlive us for 4 billion years. But the Earth, if it's going to be thrown by us into a new system of balance, it may very well create a system of balance where we cannot sustain our civilization. It is that serious, folks. And you know, it's like what I said George, when I had everybody raise their hands in the last time we were in Everett.
Right.
And you know what happened the day after all that?
What happened?
We started 2 months of forest fire fog.
Oh, jeez.
And it was like I basically told everybody to raise their hands if they believe climate change was a hoax. And then I had this weird message to say, okay, how many of you will change your mind by the year 2028? And it kind of blocked everybody. But I then said on the show, as I recall, most of you will have changed your mind by then, but it might be too late.
Now, her other question about the candidates that could run against President Trump. I'm going to throw out a name for you, John.
Okay.
Former Vice President Joe Biden, I think, could be the front runner for the Democratic Party.
He's too old.
He's 75 right now. You're right.
Yeah. He's. I don't see him. I know that Elizabeth Warren, I used to say, was going to make a run years ago, long before Trump was there. I think she might try. Frankly, what I'm seeing now is there's no one. There's no one on. As long as the Democrat Party puts all their energy in tearing down what is currently the regime in Washington, rather than as long as the Democratic Party keeps blaming Russian unicorns and Russian bots and not look at the fact that they lost because they didn't play the Electoral College, which is our system, like it or not, you can change it, but this is what happened. In short, I think I would love to see the opposition party be healthy again. I don't think it's very healthy in its mind right now because It's in anger, it's in destruction, it's in negativity, and that just doesn't win over the other half of the United States. You've got to find a vision that's going to be better than what Donald Trump is saying and the Republicans are saying. You've got to take their ideas and make them better and then profess them and then reach out to the people that you're calling deplorables because they're the other half of the nation. As long as the party is just magnifying polarization, they will not be back in power.
And very briefly, as we have a minute left, the midterm elections as they come up in another month, what do you think?
I mean, I'm on record saying this, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I just don't see a lot of movement.
Okay. John, thank you so much. Keep in touch with us, my friend. We think the world of you. John Hogue, up next. Between love and hate, the devil is real, and he's plotting to get your soul.